The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
Ed Shames of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division, was one of the earliest paratroopers in the U.S. Army. Though he enlisted as a buck private, he rose to become an operations sergeant prior to receiving the first battlefield commission of D-Day following his jump into France. After fighting in Holland, Colonel Shames joined the 506th famed Easy Company, today known as the Band of Brothers, just in time for some of the hardest fighting the company would see. In this two-part episode of Veterans Chronicles, Colonel Shames sits down with American Veterans Center President Jim Roberts to recount his experiences training and fighting as a paratrooper in the U.S. Army during World War II.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. This is Jim Roberts, and I'm sitting in for Gene Pell. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest Colonel Ed Shames, veteran of Easy Company, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division, better known as the Band of Brothers from the famous book and film. Colonel Shames, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Well, let's start with the beginning. Give us a bit about your personal background, where you're from and where you grew up.
I'm from born in Norfolk, Virginia in 1922 and lived there until World War II. Joined the Army September, or rather last week of August 1942, and I joined the 506th Parachute Infantry about a week later.
Well, you definitely have that Tidewater accent.
Thank you, sir.
Very, very distinct.
Thank you, sir.
Tell us, first of all, how the 506th got organized in World War II.
506th was organized at Fort Monroe, Virginia, because the Army needed a super unit, according to the civilians at the War Department. They wanted something to bow the public trust back to the services because of the difficulty they had at Pearl Harbor, the Bataan Death March, the loss of Wake Island, and we were in throes of being very disgusted with everything in life. And they came up with the fact that they wanted something to stir up the Army and form a super unit, the 506th Parachute Infantry.
You've remarked in the past that the state of the U.S. military prior to World War II was really not a very good one. It was hardly an elite group of people, right?
Well, the Army consisted of about 250,000 men and officers. And they were made up, of course, of people who could not find a job during the Depression. People didn't have food on the tables. And most of the people that joined the Army joined because they could get a paycheck for themselves as well as sending a few dollars home. They used to send about half of that money home. For an example, gasoline at that time was about 6 gallons for a dollar. And when they made $21 a month, you can imagine they had to buy groceries and so forth out of that. So they needed some kind of work, some kind of a method to make a living, just to put food on the table and rent to have something over their heads for that family.
Now, the 506th, as I recall, was the first paratroop unit we had in this country. Isn't that correct?
No, sir. They had had other units that were formed from regular Army that did not really work successfully. So, therefore, they wanted to recruit strictly from civilian ranks in order to form the 506th. It was to be a new concept altogether.
I see. And how many men applied for entry into the 506th?
The civilians of the War Department decided or talked about thinking that they could recruit at least 2,000 men for this unit. They needed 2,800 for a regiment, but they figured that 2,000 would be all that would join such a unit because of the method that they wanted to recruit. They wanted nothing but the top physical people. They wanted people with IQs of 110 or better. And in that respect, 2,000 would be all that they could imagine that would recruit. But they did recruit 7,000 on top of everything.
How did the 506th end up at Toccoa, Georgia?
Okay. When I joined the unit, I joined at Fort Monroe, Virginia. And, of course, I was supposed to have my mother sign for me because I wasn't 20 years old. And, of course, all of us had our mother sign for them. I don't think a mother signed at all. We lied. And we got to they sent me to Fort Lee, Virginia. At that time, Camp Lee, Virginia, about 60 miles from Norfolk. And about 5 days later, from the center at Fort Lee, they sent me down to Toccoa, Georgia. They got to Toccoa because nobody wanted the 506 as their unit in their command. Fort Meade didn't want them. Fort Bragg didn't want them. Fort Benning didn't want them. So they finally came up with this abandoned field at Toccoa, Georgia.
All right, and so Toccoa was originally known by another name, correct?
Toccoa was known as Camp Toombs, named after a Georgia senator that he wanted to secede from the Union back in 1850. He was an ardent segregationist, and naturally they couldn't keep the name Toombs. They had to change it to Camp Toccoa.
So what was training like there at Toccoa? I mean, this was something entirely new in the U.S. Army, correct?
That's correct. Toccoa, Georgia, was a very difficult training area because of the fact it was in Georgia clay to begin with, and they had some training schedules that were very difficult for any unit. As a matter of fact, they started us off running Currahee Mountain. They had so many people, they had to weed them down. So if you didn't run Currahee in prescribed time, you were bumped out of the unit right away. And they also had training units whereby to get to the training unit, you had to walk 8 or 10 miles to get to the training and then walk back that night after training. So it was very difficult. As a matter of fact, no one walked the streets in Toccoa during training hours. Everyone ran. So it was a matter of trying to build up your body as well as your mind.
Now, in the film, your commanding officer there, Captain Sobel, was portrayed as something of an SOB, I think it's fair to say. How accurate was that portrayal?
Well, Captain Sobel actually made the men what they were. He was a disciplinarian. He was very hard on the men when they were out of step. He, as I say, he actually made the unit what it was by the actions he took.
So you would describe him as fair but tough.
He was fair but very tough, very tough. And, of course, some of the officers didn't like him, and most of the men didn't like him. But, nevertheless, he was what they needed to toughen the men up.
So after the basic training, that intense basic training you went through there at Toccoa, Currahee, on to jump school. Talk about that a bit, if you would.
Okay. In order, we had so many people that we had to get rid of these folks to bring us down to TONE, Table of Organization and Equipment. Table of Organization would be the number of people that you had to comprise a regiment. We had to get down to at least about 3,200 people for the regiment of a regiment that would normally acquire about 2,800.
So you got to get rid of more than half of the the recruiting.
At least half of the people that we first took in.
Right.
When we came, finished our 16 weeks basic training at the Corps, we were all pretty good soldiers, but still we had too many men. We still had to get rid of these men. So the it was three battalions in a regiment, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. The 1st battalion that was made up at the beginning had just about the correct number of people for the battalion. The 2nd battalion had a lot of men over, above of what they needed, and the 3rd battalion had way too many men. The 2nd battalion, in order to weed them down further, decided that to go down to Benning for their jump training.
Fort Benning.
Fort Benning. They would decide to walk from Tacoma to Atlanta so that they can eliminate the people that couldn't make it. They're still definitely training. They lost a lot of men by the time they got to Atlanta, and they were in pretty good shape to do that jump training at Fort Benning. After they got through at Fort Benning, it was third time for the 3rd Battalion. That was my battalion to begin with. We had way too many men, so they decided, I started to say we decided, we didn't decide a thing, they decided that we would ride to Atlanta from Tacoma and then walk from Atlanta to Fort Benning, a total of 149 miles, but we would do it the same time it took the 2nd Battalion to walk 119 miles. So we finally completed our trip to Fort Benning, and when we got to Fort Benning, Fort Benning Jump School greeted us with big signs saying, "Welcome, 3rd Battalion, 506 Parachute Infantry, long walkie, big talkie, no jumpy." So that was our greetings when we got into Fort Benning.
All right, we'll pick up your training there with jump training after we pause for this commercial break.
Colonel Shames discusses the trials of jump training at Fort Benning when Veterans Chronicles returns.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Though airborne units were not popular among many of the Army's top commanders, those who believed in the concept knew that in order to succeed in combat, American paratroopers needed to be trained into an elite force. Our discussion continues as Colonel Ed Shames recalls the grueling training to which paratrooper candidates were subjected.
Colonel, before the break, you were about to talk about your parachute jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia. Could you pick up the story there?
Fort Benning, of course, didn't like us any better than anyone else at that time. The Army decided that we were doing something that was strictly against Army regulations and going into jump school without having gone through regular basic training with the Army. So they tried to make it as difficult as they could on us. And they devised all kinds of activities for us over and above what we would normally get in jump school. As a matter of fact, when we first started, the 3rd Battalion was in formation, and we were given a lecture saying how tough it was going to be. And, of course, it was going to be in three phases, A phase, B phase, and C phase. A phase would be physical training, physical hardening, not realizing what the Corps was. They didn't care about
what you just gone through, right?
That's right, but they didn't care about the Corps, never heard of the Corps, didn't want to hear about them. They just wanted to get rid of us. So they told us that they were going to run us down pretty good, and what was left, we would be able to be in good shape to jump. We started running. We ran for about 2.5 hours, and we thought that the teachers were going to die because of the running that we did, and they finally stopped and wanted to know if we'd had enough. In unison, we practically yelled out, we thought we were just warming up. Let's do some running. So that took care of A training. And then B training was, of course, the physical attributes of the parachute, how to pack it, and so forth, so on. And, of course, beginning of C training, that was the jump itself and the harness fitting and so forth. So, again, they tried all kinds of tricks. They didn't discourage us a bit. Just about every one of us that finished the march from Atlanta to Benning finished that jump training. In most cases, we jumped in 2 days, 5 jumps. A lot of cases, we did all 5 in 1 day.
Now, how many of those were from an airplane?
5 of them were from an airplane.
Okay.
5.
But you started
We started tower jumping.
Tower jumping,
yes,
right.
Tower jumping. And they devised what they call some sort of a things that no one ever heard of. They strapped us to an I-beam, about a 12-foot I-beam, hauled us up on a tower and counted to 3, and we were supposed to pull a ripcord, and it was the first bungee jumps that was ever devised. Mm. We fell about 50 feet, and then, of course, the bungee rubber bands pulled us back up after getting almost close to the ground. But none of us, we didn't like it, but none of us dropped out because of it.
I venture to say that very few of you, if any, had ever been in an airplane before, right?
We figured out later that about 97% of us had never even ridden in an airplane, let alone
jump from one.
Yes.
So, all right, you've completed basic training and jump school, and then you're ready for deployment, right?
Well, no, we went from jump school, we went to advanced infantry training. Again, no one wanted us, and they carved out a section of Fort Bragg called, McCall. They carved out a camp called Camp McCall, which was adjacent to Fort Bragg, which was part of Fort Bragg, but they didn't want it to name it Fort Bragg. They still were waiting for us to fall flat on our faces. And we finally went through advanced training there, just as hard as it was at the Corps. February, March, and April, and then May started the maneuvers, Tennessee maneuvers, where all the units had a chance to interact with one another. And this is the time they figured they were going to get rid of us for sure, because they gave us all kinds of odd tasks to do. And we were blue forces one day, red forces the next day. Finally, they gave us a task to storm a mountain, face of a mountain, where they had a unit embedded on the front of this mountain, a whole division. And they said, okay, 506, you're to attack this division. And it was going to be a frontal attack, but we decided instead of a frontal attack, we would go behind the mountain, which they thought it was impossible to do. Hmm. But we did it. We started about 8 o'clock in the evening. We got up to the top of the mountain. At midnight, about 2 o'clock in the morning, we came back down on them in the face of the mountain. We just about disseminated a whole division. And they finally told us to get the hell out of there and go back to Fort Bragg, so we could go overseas and go some real fighting.
All right, Colonel, when we get back, we'll continue the story with your deployment to Britain. Right now, we pause for a brief commercial break.
When Veterans Chronicles returns, Colonel Shames talks about his first promotion, his deployment to Great Britain, and preparations for the D-Day invasion.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. As the men of the 506th Parachute Infantry prepare to ship out to Britain, Ed Shames received his first promotion, becoming Operations Sergeant and joining the staff of the 3rd Battalion Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Lee Wolverton.
Colonel, before the break, you had walked us through your basic training, jump school, advanced maneuvers, and at this point you are ready to embark for England. Tell us about that. Where did you go to embark?
Let's start back over just for a moment at Camp McCall. Camp McCall is where I received my first real promotion from a PFC to a sergeant, and then a week later to staff sergeant as the operations sergeant of the 3rd Battalion. Because of my knowledge of maps and operations of the unit, I was asked to be, or told to be, the operations sergeant of the 3rd Battalion.
What does that entail exactly, the operations sergeant?
I was the assistant to the operation officer, in charge of formulating positions, formulating exercises, battlefield formations and what have you. We were the operating part of the battalion. We did the formulating of the companies and the platoons. We did the maps and the jump areas and so forth, the whole works, as far as the fighting part is concerned.
All right, so when time came for you to deploy, where did you deploy from?
We deployed from New York City, and from New York, but then we didn't get to see much of New York. We were sort of quarantined in this small camp outside of the harbor, and it was time to get on top of the ship, the Samaria. It was a British ship, if you'd call it a ship. It was a transport, and it was from World War One. And it was horrible. It was a horrible voyage all the way across. The food was inedible. We couldn't get a bath. You couldn't get a shave. You couldn't hardly sleep because it was so crowded. 5,000 men on a ship that normally carried about 600 passengers.
Wow.
So it was not good. But nevertheless, we got off at Liverpool, England, where we caught trains at middle of the night, and we were shipped over to our various small stations in England, in the southwestern part of England. I went to a little town called Ramsbury, and at Ramsbury is where we stayed until from September until the time we went to make the invasion into Normandy.
Must have been quite a culture shock, I would think, for you American GIs setting foot in England, right?
Well, it was, but we managed. We were pretty compatible with the English. The Englishmen treated us very well. We had no real problems. The money problem was trying to figure out what the money was when we first got over there. But otherwise, we did fine. I lived with an English family. I was billeted with an English family. A few non-coms were allowed to be billeted with families because they didn't have enough room in their barracks and Quonset huts. Mm-hmm. But I was very fortunate to be with another sergeant, and we lived with I lived over top of a grocery, a greengrocer. These people had nothing to do with us at all for the very first 2 weeks. But after that, we became very good friends and very dear friends, as a matter of fact. So,
what were conditions like in Britain during that time?
Very tight, mm-hmm. very tight. Everything was rationed. The men were all at war. The women did all the work. They cleaned the streets. They did the firemen's act and so forth and so on. It was very tough for them.
What happened in terms of training in England?
Training was just as severe as it was in Tekoa and it was in McCall. We continued day and night, 6 days a week. We went to different places in England on our day off, but it was no let up. We knew we had something to do. It was going to be an invasion. We didn't know when. We didn't know where. But we certainly knew it was going to happen.
Now, your commanding officer, Captain Sobel, was reassigned, right?
He was reassigned, right. He was reassigned.
He became the
jump school commandant. We had a jump school where we had replacements taking training for jumping. And he did a good job. He did a very fine job there. And, of course, we had one officer that took over the company, and then, of course, Captain Winters took over from him. So I was still with the 3rd Battalion at that time, but I knew exactly what happened with the E Company because Operations Sergeant is supposed to know everything was going on.
Why was Captain Sobel reassigned?
Well, he was reassigned because of the rumors that went around that he was incompetent. He was tough on the people, and it was a matter of fact that he just did not have the personality as most officers would have, and maybe he wasn't as tough as some of them that we had in 3rd Battalion. But it so happened that so much pressure was put on Colonel Sink that he decided to reassign him.
You mentioned Colonel Sink, the regimental commander. Talk about him a bit, if you would. He was
Colonel Sink, quite
a character.
Colonel Sink was a character in himself. He was a recovered alcoholic, maybe not necessarily 100% recovered, but he was a good soldier. He was an excellent soldier. He was a demanding soldier, and he knew what he had to do, and he wanted to had the very best regiment that's ever been in the history of the American Army, and he succeeded.
Well, tell us a little about his background, if you would.
Colonel Sink was a West Pointer. I think he completed West Point in 1927, and he was known as an alcoholic, and the Army really wanted to get rid of him, but because of the factor that his family owned about 6 or 7 newspapers, it was very difficult for them to do so and not create a problem, so they kept him on. And when they found out that they had this unit that they knew were not going to be successful, they decided to sign him, which was a great thing for both of them. He was very successful. And he formed, as I say, a unit that was second to none in the American Army.
How about the operations officer for the regiment?
For the battalion.
For the battalion, excuse me.
Captain Nixon.
Captain Nixon.
When I became, we didn't get that far yet for combat, so can we wait one moment on that?
Okay, we'll come back.
Okay, we'll come back. Let's get into combat first.
Anything else you'd like to say about the training you received?
No, the training,
in England?
As I say, was very, very strenuous. It continued that way, and thank goodness, because that brought us a lot of us back, and that was why we were successful.
All right, let's move up to D-Day itself and the preparations for that.
Very good. Okay, three units, three battalions were going to jump into Normandy, and we jumped at various airfields. My particular airfield was Exeter, England. I was the one that, because of the operations sergeant, I had to prepare the sand tables, and I did a beautiful job of sand tables. Sand tables is a map that's on the ground. It's a map that's supposed to see when you jump out of the airplane, you're supposed to see the map in front of you so you know exactly where to go when you hit the ground. They say it was a work of art. The only thing about it, nobody hit the ground at the right place.
Right.
So it was a job done that was in vain.
Well, when you were constructing this sand table, did you know what it represented or where
the topography
right, was?
Right. Just before the orders to move out, the colonel and his staff preceded the unit going to Exeter, at which time Chafe Headquarters, Supreme Allied Command, had a meeting showing us where we were going to drop and the whole Operation Overlord, the whole Operation of Normandy. And therefore, each unit that was at this meeting got orders of what they were supposed to do and where they were supposed to land. And we got them about 2 days before the regular unit did, and Colonel Wolverton, my commander, battalion commander, said to me, he said, you get enough people that you need to create this sand table, and here are your orders. Here are the photographs of the areas that we're going to be in, and do get all the materials you need to form this sand table, which I did. And I had a special tent where we were to be briefed.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the men came in, the sand table was complete, and we start briefing. We briefed units, one unit at a time. As a matter of fact, we got down to the fact that we were briefing one platoon, and in some cases, one squad. Colonel Wolverton said to me, no matter, you stay in that tent day and night until everybody knows exactly where they are supposed to be, when they are supposed to be there. Which I did, of course. I was ordered to do so. It was about, I guess, 4 days of the sand table briefing. I had one sergeant who came into the briefing tent about, I guess, 14 times. My assistant, Sergeant Garance, my assistant, said to me, he said, that sergeant must be pretty dumb. And I remarked to him, I said, no, on the contrary, I think he's pretty wise. He wants to know exactly where his men are supposed to be, and he's going to be there at the time he's supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened that the sergeant didn't get to where he was supposed to be because nobody did.
Right.
And he got killed that night, so that takes care of that man.
What was the company's assignment that you were given?
We had my battalion was supposed to ward off the enemy from crossing two bridges over the Douve River, which connected the mainland to the beaches. We were to prevent any armor coming from the mainland go to the beaches to prevent the beach forces from coming in, making a foothold. And that was the job that we were supposed to do for the bridges. We accomplished our mission.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little more detail just in a minute. How about the preparations for the invasion itself? The amount of equipment you had, airplanes?
Well, we had about, each man carried about 150 pounds of equipment, at least, some of them more, very few less. We had everything that we needed to be on the ground for at least 3 days. Of course, we were on there more than that, but that was the idea. We had mortars. We had machine guns. We had, of course, our individual weapons. We had belts of ammunition for crew-served weapons that we carried for the machine gunners. They couldn't carry as much as they needed. each man had at least two mortar shells in their packs so that the mortarmen didn't have to carry more than they could possibly carry. We had all the food we needed, supposed to be for 2 or 3 days, 3 days at least. We had our shovel, our first aid packets. We even had a sack for our bed sack, like a mattress cover. And people want to know what we carried a mattress cover for wrapped around our body. In case we got killed, they want to put something. We put something in the back in the mattress cover. Us, that was part of the equipment. So we were loaded down pretty good, and I was told to stay in that tent until the colonel called for me to complain, and he said he would send a runner to get me and fold up every tent, get all my maps down, and I would be on his command plane. That's where I was supposed to jump from. About time to leave, the runner came and said, "Sergeant Shames, Colonel Wolverton says, time to plane." I went up to the plane. The runner helped me get in my equipment. I was getting ready to get on the plane, and Colonel Wolverton said, "You've moved. Let's go to another plane because I have a gentleman here that's taking your place. He's a spotter for the Nevada. So you get on plane so-and-so," and I did. But every person on the plane that I was supposed to get on either was murdered or captured.
Oh, wow. Well, Colonel, let's continue our discussion, but we have to pause now for a brief commercial break.
Colonel Shames and American Veterans Center President Jim Roberts continue their discussion of the Normandy invasion when Veterans Chronicles returns.
The stories of America's fighting soldiers, sailors, and aviators, unfiltered. Join Gene Pell as an honored roster of guests tell their stories from the front lines of war. Listen to what happened during our nation's times of war from the people who experienced it. Hear it each week on Veterans Chronicles.
Shortly after midnight on the morning of June 6, 1944, 24,000 British, American, Canadian, and Free French airborne troops began dropping behind enemy lines from the skies above Normandy. Among these men was Ed Shames of 3rd Battalion, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division. As part one of this episode of Veterans Chronicles concludes, Colonel Shames shares his initial experience in the D-Day assault.
Colonel, just before the break, we had gotten to the point when you were planning for your landing in Normandy. You want to pick up the story there?
Right. As I said, that I had to get on another plane. When I got on to the plane tarmac, the jump master said, "Knew me. I don't know to this day what plane I got on. In fact, I'm not even shown on any roster, any manifest. I can't even prove that I jumped into Normandy." But he asked me to jump, go to the back of the plane and make sure everyone got out of the plane when it's time to go. So I said, "Yes, sir." Jumped on. I knew him that time. I do not know who he was now. Got on the plane, got in the very back. When we flew over to the channel, red light showed, then the green light. And everybody starts shuffling to get out of the plane. Flak was everywhere.
Was it very heavy?
Everywhere. It looked like 4th of July on fireworks day. Mm-hmm. Stuff coming through the plane. You could hear it popping through the wings of the plane. And when I finally got up to stand up to move, the man in front of me, number 18, slipped. He was carrying a mortar, 60-millimeter mortar. By the time I got him on his feet, of course, I don't know how many miles or how many feet that the plane had gone. But when I jumped out of the plane, I must have been way high because they were probably taking evasive action, because it seemed to me it took forever for me to get down, and stuff was going through the chute. I hear the noise to this day. It's a peculiar noise that you don't forget. No other noise is like it. Mm-hmm. And finally, I got to the ground. And when I got down to the ground, I knew that I was in the wrong place because nothing looked anywhere near what I was supposed to, where I was supposed to be. As a matter of fact, I was at a barnyard, some barnyard with a bunch of cows. And I decided to learn how to move like a cow so I could at least throw somebody off. And I found out later where I was. Had I known where I was then, I would not be here today because I would have dropped dead right then. I found out that I was landed in the milk factory of Carentan. And that was one place that I'd put on my sand table, a little sign, avoid. Avoid at all costs, because that was a command of the core headquarters of the German Army.
Which is where you landed.
Yes, sir. Right there.
All right, so you're on the ground, and I heard you talk once before about your objective when you were in the air being to get the hell on the ground and find a place to hide.
Right. Well, the first thing I did was cut myself out of the chute, and I didn't take time to unbuckle. I couldn't quite make it around the cow, so I took my knife out and I cut all the shroud lines off, and I got the hell out of there. And I noticed that there was a tracer plane that we had been notified of that went from north to south, like a satellite that you see in the air. Of course, I knew that because I was the operations sergeant. So I got my bearings of that, not knowing where I was, of course. And I decided I had to go north, which I did. I crawled a fence. I got out, and I noticed that we were in a canal group of trenches, and I crossed the canal, and I still went north.
Now, how far were you from where you were supposed to have been?
About 4 or 5 miles, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 miles, and equidistant from the bridges. Of course, I did not know that then, so I was about, I guess, 5 minutes. I picked up a man. He had no more idea where he was than a man in the moon. Of course, I did that time either. But I had an idea that I was supposed to go north. So I picked him up, and then a few minutes later, picked up another one. Finally, I had 6 men with me. And needless to say, they were frightened to death. I didn't want to let them know I was frightened to death as well. But I told them, I said, now look, I said, instead of us milling around not knowing what we're doing, let's find out from one of these farmers where we are.
Join us again next time for the conclusion of this two-part episode of Veterans Chronicles as Colonel Ed Shames recalls the epic Allied invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pelcom Communications. A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.